gets now, and your workers can fly through those too.
If you'd all silence your phones, we are going to get started. Today is Friday, April 14th, 2017. This is session 5114 on space ethics, asking the tough questions. My name is Robert Pasnow. I'm a professor in the philosophy department here and director of the Center for Western Civilization, Thought and Policy, and I feel like just about the luckiest person on the planet or off of it to be have a front row seat for this session. I've been looking forward to it all week. I'm just going to very briefly introduce the speakers and hand things over to them. Our first speaker is going to be David Grinspoon. He's a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and an adjunct professor of astrophysical and planetary science at the University of Colorado. He's the inaugural chair of astrobiology at the U.S. Library of Congress. He's the author and editor of several books. His newest, Earth in Human Hands, was named the best science book of 2016 by NPR's Science Friday. The second speaker is going to be Loretta Hidalgo-Whitesides. Her background is in astrobiology. She's trained at Stanford and Caltech, and she has been all over this planet and off of it. She's gone to the Canadian Arctic to study plant life. She's descended to the bottom of the oceans with James Cameron to film an IMAX documentary on what lives at the bottom of the seas. She spent a great deal of time off this planet, floating weightless in space, involved in the Virgin Galactic extraplanetary project. Our final speaker is going to be Michelle Thaler. She is the Deputy Director of Science for Communications at NASA headquarters. She's a regular host of Discovery Science Channel's How the Universe Works and also hosts the podcast Orbital Path on public radio. All right, without further ado, then let me hand things over to the speakers.
Wonderful to be here this morning, and I'm excited to be on a panel with these two characters. And thank you all so much for coming out at this early hour to talk about space ethics. I know it's a little unusual for this conference, but I'm going to start off my presentation with a PowerPoint slide. And it's kind of a weird PowerPoint slide because it's an imaginary PowerPoint slide. And so it might be hard for you to see. I can see it, but I'm going to describe it to you so that I'm feeding back a little. Is there somebody actually mixing? There's a slight, very high frequency squeal. Awesome. Thank you. Perfect. I'm going to describe it to you to help you see it. Okay. So here's the this laser. It doesn't really matter if this is working. Oh yeah, there it is. So here's the slide. You can see, and there are three photographs, as you can see. On the left, this laser pointer is cutting in and out, and it really doesn't matter at all. On the left, you see this photograph is a beautiful picture taken by one of the Mars exploration rovers. This one was taken by Opportunity as it wound across the plains of Mars. And you can see it's a beautiful, desolate plain of rippling sand going off into the Martian distance. Lovely vista. And crossing over it, there are these tracks, these rover tracks. This is a photo that was taken by Opportunity looking back over where it's been. So there's nothing that's touched this surface in billions of years, certainly nothing, no artifact of civilization except for these tracks crossing it. It's a lovely picture of where we've been on Mars. Now, in the second picture in the middle, you can see is somewhat similar, but very different. It's a beach. It's actually Nauset Beach in Massachusetts and on Cape Cod. And you can see it's a beautiful beach scene, but it's carved up obnoxiously by some dune buggy tracks, like maybe some drunken teenagers or whatever were crashing over this beach and carving up what was otherwise a pristine landscape and even possibly crashing through some sand dunes where some terns were trying to nest, some endangered birds, a real like act of vandalism. And then in this third photograph, over here on the right, you can see it's a rocky vista, and there are some fossil footprints. In fact, these are the earliest known fossil footprints of a creature that first walked on the land on Earth hundreds of millions of years ago. Before that time, all life on Earth was confined to the oceans. And then at some point, there was this evolutionary leap where creatures first ventured onto the land and left tracks. You can see this PowerPoint slide. And look again at that picture on the left of the Martian tracks crossing that beautiful, desolate, mostly empty landscape. And ask yourself, which of these other two photographs does that most resemble for you? Does it conjure up this act of vandalism of the dune buggies carving up that beach? Or does it conjure up this evolutionary leap of life for the first time reaching a new realm and leaving its mark and entering a new phase of the cosmic evolution of life? So that's one way to encapsulate one of the questions that we might consider when we talk about ethics of space. A lot of times when you meet people and you say you're in space exploration, at a party, especially after a couple of beers, and people get a little belligerent, and they want to challenge you, and they'll say, well, what are we doing messing up other planets when we're doing such a bad job here on Earth? Or do we want to go and, like, screw up other planets too? Shouldn't we leave them alone? It's a legitimate question. I don't think it's an unfair question to ask. And I'm always drawn personally towards this image of the evolutionary leap of life reaching a new realm. But I think it's certainly a fair question, and we ought to be mindful of our impacts. Another related question is the junk we left on the moon. Is that okay to just leave our stuff places? Again, I'm telling you my biases here, but I'm also acknowledging the question. I picture the Apollo 11 landing site as this beautiful, historic, archaeological site that will be revered by future humans, just as we revere, the caves of Lascaux and those paintings, as some historically important site. But, it doesn't mean, we should just leave our trash everywhere as we go around the solar system. At some point, we might live to regret that. So it's, a lot of these questions are questions of balance. And when we move some of our ethical questions into the space realm, it also is valuable for helping us rethink some of the questions here on Earth, because it really takes us into a different context. One other area, I'm just going to mention a couple other areas that are sort of fruitful in this larger realm of space ethics. And I know my colleagues are going to raise some other questions too. And then some of these are ones we can come back to in the discussion. But there's an area of concern that we in the planetary exploration business refer to as planetary protection. And that is involved with the concern about contaminating other planets as we explore. And it goes both ways. There's the worry that we could inadvertently bring organisms to another planet, which could potentially have caused two problems. There's I think of them as a crime against nature versus a crime against science. Whereas one is like, what if we mess up a pre-existing biosphere, inadvertently cause harm to organisms that live on Mars or somewhere else, or Europa or somewhere else? And the other is simply, what if we confuse ourselves by, when we go back and look for life, we find organisms, and can we be sure that we didn't just bring them ourselves? And so that's the crime against science. These are two reasons why we think about this. And the other area of concern is, so that's what we call forward contamination. That's the lingo, bringing stuff from Earth elsewhere. There's also the concern about back contamination. What if we bring something dangerous back to Earth? And we're careful about that, too, and we have procedures and protocols. And, in fact, NASA has an Office of Planetary Protection. And there's even someone whose job title is Planetary Protection Officer, which I just think is so cool, you know, men in black. Although in this case, right now, it's a woman in wearing different colors. But and her name is Cassie Conley, and she's awesome. And this job has been held by several different people. It makes me proud to be part of NASA, that this it's really an ethical wing of NASA. And we take this seriously. And in fact, the space agencies of the world have always taken this seriously from the beginning of the time when we started first launching spacecraft off of Earth. There were people that raised this issue of planetary protection, and there are international agreements about how to treat this. And not just NASA, the Russians and others are getting into the space game now. And these agreements are signed by all the countries that have the ability to launch things into space. And it's taken seriously. We can't completely sterilize every spacecraft we send to Mars. There are, in fact, Earth organisms living on Mars now, we know, on our spacecraft. But we clean them, and there's requirements that it should be below a certain load. And we even have rules about where spacecraft can go on Mars. And one of the strange things that comes out of this is we're not allowed to go to the places we're most interested in studying. Because the places we are most interested in studying are places where there could be liquid water, and yet there's concern about contamination. So there's sort of a balance here. How careful should we be? Now we're balancing exploration and science goals versus the ethical concerns. And it's a constant, there's no obvious correct answer, but it is an area that NASA worries about and holds workshops. And to me, the whole subject of planetary protection is just sort of an interesting ethical example for how we might treat other questions too, because it logically doesn't seem like something we should worry about. And I don't say that because I'm unconcerned with ethics. I say that because it seems very, very unlikely, given what we know about how biology works and how specific biology is to a planetary environment. It seems very unlikely that something from Mars could come here and hurt us. If there are Martian organisms, they're going to be very well adapted to Mars. And the diseases that are dangerous for us have co-evolved with us, and they very specifically like to, you know, eat our specific amino acids and our specific proteins and things that Martian organisms, presumably, if they've evolved separately, are not going to be as tasty for terrestrial diseases. And I think that would work both ways. So my hunch, based on what I know and what we know about biology, is that we probably don't really need to worry about this being dangerous. But that hunch could be wrong, and the whole It's an example of an ethical question where the chances of doing something wrong are extremely, extremely low. Like, probably, you know, if you had to put it a number, it would be 10 to the minus some large, you know, more than one in a million or one in a billion chance that this mistake could do something bad. But if it does something bad, the bad thing could be really bad, like destroy all life on Earth. So it's one of these things where you're trying to balance a very low probability event with the really huge consequences of being wrong about that. And so we even have to ask ourselves, I'm really sorry to quote Donald Rumsfeld in this audience, but we do have to ask ourselves about the unknown unknowns. What if we're fundamentally wrong about biology? You know, science at any given time always thinks that it's figured everything out, right? And we basically know how the universe works and how life works, and it's just figuring out the details. What if we're making some big mistake? We don't want to risk the whole game on that. So there are other ethical problems we have here on Earth with certain technologies that are similar, where it seems very unlikely that a mistake would be bad, but if it was bad, then it would be really bad. So it's another way in which the space ethics can also be an arena where we try to wrestle with this type of question. Personally, I think we're hitting it right with planetary protection. We're being careful, but we're still exploring. You know, if you want to be the most careful you could be, you would never leave the house in the morning, right? Because you could get hit by a bus, and then you would not have a very interesting life. So you can't, there is such a thing as being too careful, right? And even so, your house could get hit by a meteorite, and you can't always be safe. But I think we're hitting it right with planetary protection. One last ethical conundrum I'll mention and then turn it over to my colleagues. There is this idea that we might someday soon want to colonize Mars. I don't like that word colonize, because of its unfortunate historical resonance. And the fact is, moving to a place where there are no human beings, there never have been human beings, is a different ethical conundrum than moving to a place than colonizing a place where people have lived before. So I say, let's never use that word colonize again when we talk about space. Let's talk about settling other planets or whatever. I mean, but it's just a word, but it piques these reactions. Anyways, but then there's the question, should we ultimately try to permanently implant life on Mars or somewhere else and possibly even change that planet, terraform it to make it more suitable for an Earth environment? And there's different ethical responses to that. One obvious one is like, no, why should we interfere with another planet? Let's leave it alone, the principle of non-interference. And that's sort of a natural thing to think. And I think that, personally, I think if we do find there are Martians, or even if we're not sure whether or not there are Martians, we should be very cautious about our imprint on Mars, because we don't want to inadvertently commit biocide on another planet. But if there comes a time in the future where we're pretty sure, or very sure, or have determined that there is no life on Mars, and that's a whole other question how we would reach that conclusion, then you can argue, and it has been argued, I think correctly, that the ethical imperative then reverses, and it is then our ethical obligation to bring life to Mars. Why would you say that? Believe it or not, it comes from the principle of deep ecology, which says that you value life, all life, above everything else, not just human life. And the analogy is, if you're living in a beautiful garden and next door there's a vacant lot, there's nothing living, don't you want to throw a few seeds over that fence and start a garden there? And especially, what if your beautiful garden is the home of some endangered species that only lives in that one place and therefore is inherently threatened by only living in that one garden, and you could make sure that it's much more likely to survive and not be wiped out by spreading it to other gardens? Well, all life on Earth is in that situation of the endangered species living on only one garden. Planetary disasters do happen. So if you love life and you want it to exist, if you love Earth life and you want it to perpetuate, then at some point, arguably, it becomes our ethical obligation to spread beyond one planet and ensure the survival of life. And with that, I'll turn it over to my esteemed colleagues.
That's fantastic. One of the things I really like that Elon Musk says is when he describes that process of like bringing life to Mars, and he calls it backing up the biosphere. And as a biologist, I thought that's a really clever, cool phrase. The idea of taking Earth life and making sure we've got a backup copy. That's a computer guy for you. So I come from the human spaceflight side of the house, and my passion is really, bringing people out into space and the opportunity that gives us as a species. Because when astronauts and cosmonauts go out into space and they look back at our Earth, they report having this really profound experience. We call it the overview effect. And it's basically falling in love with Earth. You look back and you see this beautiful globe and you see the thin atmosphere, and all you want to do, and everything you've ever known, everything you've ever loved, is on that globe, and you just want to protect it and take care of it. And I think that's a really important experience for people to have. And only 550 or so people have ever done that, have ever been into space. Now with Virgin Galactic getting ready to start launching paying customers, and in SpaceX, hopefully moving towards launching paying customers in the next few years, and Blue Origin as well, and other players like Worldview with their balloon that they're going to take people up to, to high altitudes with, we'll be able to double that number in a few years. And not just double the number, but, those are mostly government astronauts, mostly from, Russia and the United States. And so, just in our customer base, we have 650 customers who've already, paid money, bought their tickets to fly, me being one of them. And our customers are from 58 different countries. So I get really inspired imagining, this cadre of space ambassadors, returning to Earth, coming back and being able to share in their native languages, in their home communities, about this experience, and not only of feeling that connection with our home planet, but also with everyone and everyone on it. So I also see it's like it's a positive for the environment, but it's also, I think, it's a positive for, you know, the bigger things that we're dealing with as a species, just how do we get along, you know, and feeling like, you know, it's like when, you know, I went to, you know, when you have that rival college from across town and you see someone at the coffee shop and they've got the rival sweatshirt on and you're like, oh, yeah, you go to that school. But now imagine you're in another star system and you see somebody and they're cruising around and they've got a sweatshirt that says Earth on it. And you'd be like, what? You're from Earth too? That's awesome. Right? So like that's what I want to create. It's like we're all crew members, we're all crewmates on Spaceship Earth. You know, this is, we're all in this together. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, what hat you're wearing, you know, this is what binds us all together. So that's what's always motivated me. I mean, I've had my eyes on the stars since I was about 6 years old. Like this is what I'm passionate about. I grew up in like with acid rain and ozone holes and the whales. You had to save the whales in the 80s. And I was like, oh my God, there's so many problems on my planet. How do I help my planet? What do I do? And I really saw space as an opportunity to sort of bootstrap, like where we can solve all of it at once by like getting all of us to think different and take responsibility for our spaceship. So one of the things that gets me really sad is when people turn it around. And they this often happens to me at cocktail parties. So you're saying, I thought that was pretty funny. They're like, Loretta, why are we wasting all this money on space? And first of all, it's a funny thing because it's like $1 billion for, you know, billions of dollars go to NASA. It's like, you know, it's not like we're just throwing that money, you know, out into the sun or something. You know, the money actually is going to supporting, you know, postdocs and scientists and engineers and who are doing incredible innovation and thinking, and that's the kind that you want to support. So that's a good investment. But especially in the space tourism field, people are like, oh, well, these rich people are spending money to go into space. And actually, there's a movie that came out a few years ago called Elysium with the same guy from The Martian. Yeah.
That Damon.
Yeah. Thank you. How many of you guys saw Elysium? Yeah. Hopefully nobody saw it. Okay. I refused to watch it for many years because I was so crushed. Because I was like, no, Hollywood's putting out this, you know, this idea out into the world, you know, reinforcing this idea that the rich people are going to go to space and they're going to leave the trash Earth behind and they're going to bail. I'm like, oh, we screwed up this planet, we're out. And I was like, I was so crushed that this idea was going to, you know, get out in the world. But I actually ended up watching it last month because I was like, okay, this is part of my job, you know, it's my work, I got to watch this movie. And it's weird because Jodie Foster plays the bad guy. Really weird. She's a great bad guy. But anyway, but so I bring it up because I really want to challenge that notion. You know, when people say that to you, you know, like, we're just, you know, we're going to escape Earth or, you know, it doesn't matter, we'll just go to Mars and go to Mars. So I used to work in the Canadian Arctic, you know, looking at these plants. And it's incredible. You know, you go to northern Canada, and let me just say, there's not a lot of people that live in northern Canada. Very sparsely populated part of the planet. Now, there's daily commercial flights to Resolute Bay. Any one of you could just go online and buy a ticket there. And, but no, you know, most Americans aren't building summer homes up there. And, you know, but compared to Mars, it's paradise. It's above freezing in the summer. Delightful. Yeah, there's air. You can breathe. There's oxygen. You don't need a spacesuit to go out. You can actually go outside. One of the things that struck me is that we were actually outside. You know, I was like looking at the plants. We were taking measurements. We were taking pictures. We touched the water. You feel the wind on your face. But if I was actually on Mars, I'd be in a spacesuit all the time. You actually can't ever go outside. You'll be outside, but you can't experience. You won't. There'll be a plexiglass between you and outside for the until we terraform. Then it'll be much cooler.
Or genetic.
Whoa, there's a whole ethical question. Should we genetically mutant? Choose my words carefully. Alter ourselves to better suit ourselves. So I haven't gotten into that much. But I just want to
put that thought in the parking lot.
I think it's uncomfortable for me to think about. It's out of my comfort zone. It's not something I'm interested in, so I'm just like, I'll leave that to somebody else. But I love that you brought up, first of all, the terminology. I think the word you said, it's just a word. I think the words we use are really important. And I actually also don't like it when we use the word, the colonization word, because of the stigma. And I do talk about space settlement. And I have a dream of having a 10,000-person space settlement, you know, between the moon and the Earth. Kind of just like the one in Elysium. But it'll be so much cooler. It'll be so much more inclusive. So we made that point. The other thing about settlements that I want to say is I want us to learn from all this history, right? Like, otherwise we're doomed to repeat it. So the colonization model didn't work out so well for a lot of people. We're in that position again as a species where we are poised to be able to send out these people who are going to start creating these settlements and these outposts on Mars or on the moon or in open space. And, you know, how are we going to structure that? You know, if we make it so that, like, the United States or China or Russia are like, well, we paid for it, it's ours, you know, like the colonies were, essentially, you know, and we're going to get the exports out of it because we want to recoup our investment. You know, I think you're going to end up in the same situation with the colonies where they revolt and they're like, we don't want to be a part of your stinking country, we're out. So I wanted us to start thinking about a new model. And so one of the things I like to want to propose is what I call the parenting model of a settlement, which is, and it's also really applicable to space too, because people often say to me, why should we spend all this money on space? It doesn't make any sense. It's so stupid. Like, it's so expensive. Why would you do it? And I know. And I say, I know. Having children is so expensive. It doesn't make any sense. Why would anyone want to do it? It's a ton of work, and in the United States, it costs about $1 million to raise a child, and you certainly do not recoup that investment. I don't, you know, you might be hopeful, but I don't think it's going to happen. But any parent in the audience knows that you don't do it for the money. There's something else that's driving you. There's something bigger that you're called to do. There's something bigger you're called to invest in our species and give forth to our species as a parent. And I want to bring that to space, where when we send, and it's really, I never even put all these thoughts together before. This is awesome. Dialogue. It's a new thought. I'm marking it because they're so rare. You know, you're just like, I've said this 30 times and I'm going to say it one more time. So there's this idea also that the Gaia hypothesis, that the Earth is a living system, is its own
organism.
Thank you, David. And, you know, and Peter DeMann is one of my mentors, and he has this, you know, he likes to say, and we're the gametes. We're going to go out and make a new, you know, Gaia. You know, and it's a beautiful metaphor, you know, that, like, I'm a gamete, I'm a sperm, or I'm an egg, or ideally a fertilized egg. That's really the most effective. And you're going out and you're seeding life and creating another system, another ecosystem like that somewhere else. And so I just put that together. Like, yes, the space explorers, we're going out and creating new life. And then the parents on the home world are going to, you know, support it, raise it, train it, give it everything to be successful, and then let it go and hope it makes them proud. So I'll leave it there. And thank you.
The nice thing about going last is that I've been taking notes on all the neat things my colleagues have been saying here, so I've got more things I want to talk about now, but that's always a problem. But are you picking up the microphone? So it seems a little bit... Okay, good. I don't know if a lot of you actually realize that NASA has a planetary protection officer, and I have joked with her that if I had her job, I would wear black sunglasses and a thin black tie and a black suit every single day, because, I mean, how many people get that title? It is something we take very seriously. When we discovered that there was such a thing as extremophiles, which are microbes that can survive extreme conditions, as David said, we know for a fact that we have brought Earth bacteria to other planets already. So the question becomes one of how can you minimize this and how can you mitigate this problem as much as you possibly can? Because it doesn't do you a whole lot of good to say we're never going to explore ever again. And... one of the more dramatic things that I hope you guys will follow along is that our Cassini mission has been orbiting Saturn for 15 years and producing unbelievably beautiful images. If you have not seen them, go find them. They will take your breath away. And there are two moons of Saturn, Titan and Enceladus, where we do think there is a chance that there is existing life today. And because of that, Cassini has plutonium batteries, for example. We want to make sure that the Cassini spacecraft never accidentally crashes onto one of those moons, bearing not just the plutonium, but also the bacteria of Earth. And interestingly enough, the bacteria is far more dangerous than the plutonium. No, seriously. The plutonium we use, this is a little aside, the plutonium we use for our batteries is incredibly safe. It's in a ceramic form. And you could swallow pills of this stuff continuously and nothing would happen. That's why we use it. It's actually not very radioactive. It just generates heat that we can actually make electrical currents off of. But the problem is if you powderize this stuff, if you actually turn it into a very, very fine powder, it could be dangerous and it could contaminate things. So to make sure that never happens, on September 15th of this year, we are deliberately diving Cassini into Saturn. And Saturn's a big ball of hot gas in the interior, and it'll burn up in the atmosphere. It'll be completely harmless. But we think about that. We no longer can just put something up in space and leave it there. We actually have a policy now that there has to be a way to deorbit it, get rid of it, so it doesn't become dangerous space junk for somebody else. The other thing that's kind of a fun thing to think about is that we're very aware of our limitations technologically right now to protect things. We are going out to an asteroid. This mission was launched last October. It's called OSIRIS-REx, and we're going to sample the asteroid and bring it back. And not only will there be protection protocols, but we do not believe there's life on the asteroid. You never know, but we don't think so. We're protecting the sample not just for contamination from Earth, but a full 3/4 of the sample will be set aside and not analyzed. And why? Why would you go out to an asteroid, go all that way, bring back a couple kilograms of asteroid, and set aside 3/4 and not even look at it? It's because we learned a lesson from archaeology. In the Victorian age, you would find a wonderful, rusty Celtic sword somewhere in a river, and they'd go, oh, wow, let's make that look new and shiny. And they'd take steel wool, and they'd clean it off, and they'd say, look at how wonderful this artifact looks. Any archaeologist now said, what did you lose? There might have been traces of a fabric on it. There might have been traces of DNA on it. There might have been something in that that would have told us more of the story of the people that used that sword and how it got there. And we realize we've done this over and over again. We don't have the technology that we will in 100 years from now to analyze the stuff that's on this sample. You know, there are these burnt logs that they found at Herculaneum, you know, one of the Roman cities that was covered by Mount Vesuvius. And people just started to throw them away until they realized they were burned scrolls. And now we actually can, atom by atom, molecule by molecule, read what's on the scrolls. It's like, don't throw that shit away. And so we're very aware of our limitations to explore, which is something that I think a lot of people don't know. And David mentioned, and this is tantalizing to me, the places on Mars where we have an international treaty with other countries not to land are places where we think life is most likely, places where we see groundwater possibly coming up and things like that. And one of the questions, I think this is interesting, Loretta and I were talking about this beforehand, is I don't know if commercial companies are at all bound by this treaty. So, you know, if, you know, Elon Musk would like to go to Mars someday, if he does, is he bound by the treaty not to land in the places that we think are more ecologically sensitive on Mars? I don't know. I think that's something that we need to discuss, something that, you know, an argument, a discussion that needs to happen. And certainly, if somebody sends a one-way person to Mars to die, right? You know, people have talked about the idea of, you know, okay, let's have a one-way mission, and people will either survive on Mars or they'll die. A dead human on Mars is a lot of contamination, right? I mean, you've just brought a huge amount of contamination there. And you know, as nations, do we allow this? Can we say to a commercial company, don't do that? You know, I don't know what the legal repercussions of that are. And then that's something that, you know, we're just beginning to ask these questions as we begin to explore. I wanted to sort of pause a little bit because that's kind of sort of my role as a NASA scientist, but I have a different role at NASA too. And that is that I work in the Office of Communication. And I'm a scientist. I'm one of the few scientists that's actually full-time tasked to communication at NASA. And this has been an interesting example to me of the ethics of working with the public and what you tell the public. And how you communicate what's going on at NASA. And there's a lot of things that I'm not sure you're even aware of. I was talking to them that I participated in an exercise with FEMA, you know, the emergency response federal agency, about what to do in the case of a very dangerous asteroid impact, a very destructive impact. And it was a couple-day exercise. We're all around a desk in a room kind of in real time simulating what's going to happen. And, you know, for example, FEMA really wasn't used to the idea. Scientists talk about error bars. You know, when we make a discovery, how accurate is that discovery? And so we simulated to them, okay, we find an asteroid that seems to be, it's going to get close to Earth. How long until we know error bars get smaller and smaller and smaller where it's going to hit? You know, first it's going to come close to Earth, okay, then it's going to hit Earth, then it's going to hit North America, and we actually simulated it hitting in L.A. And so we actually went through the steps of when we would become more and more certain of where this thing would hit, because FEMA didn't realize that we wouldn't know exactly immediately where this thing would be going. And as this played out, we even worked with people like economists, because if you have a 5-year prior notice that LA is going away, what happens to real estate values? You know, so seriously, what happens to people that need to move? How are you going to economically handle that? But the interesting thing is that never in the course of that entire exercise, and I know you have to believe me on this, and I'll talk more about that, nowhere in the course of that exercise was there a discussion of hiding the information from the public. You have to understand, this is not something we discuss ever. When it comes to, is there an asteroid coming, will you tell us? When it comes to, do you know about alien life? I had lunch with a very lovely person yesterday who's absolutely sure I know about NASA's spacecraft that we're hiding and the aliens that we're working with. And I always try to come from a position of respect and of love. And it's hard for me to say, because you can either say it's hard to prove negative, right? Either I'm in on the conspiracy or I'm not important enough to know, fine. But I mean, I think after 20 years at NASA, I would have gotten some hint of this. And the thing that really I thought was a lot of fun this year was we discovered the star. It's called Tabby Star. That's the nickname. And it was discovered by the Kepler spacecraft to have a very, very unusual, strange signature around it. If you want to hear more, I'll go into more detail offline. But honestly, we're pretty sure this is some unusual cloud of comets, or maybe there was a planet that broke up around the star. But one of the serious suggestions from the scientists, not any fringe group, from the serious astronomers, was that we were looking at an artificial structure around the star, something made by a super advanced civilization. And people were kind of surprised that this ended up in the serious scientific discussion. And because we as astronomers would love there to be extraterrestrial life and extraterrestrial civilizations. I would be running through the streets screaming and breaking open champagne. I really want that to happen. And so this idea that we would hide things, one of the really sort of funny things, although it's not really that funny, is there was the Mayan apocalypse of 2012 where the world was going to end? And people have my number. I'm a scientist. I'm in communications. So I would field a lot of calls for this. And the week before this was supposed to happen, people were calling me saying, literally, is the world going to end next week? And I would just sort of pause. And I mean, it's one of these things where I try to be respectful, but I gently said to them, do you think I would be here at work at my desk if I thought that was true? I would be buying really good wine and maxing out my credit card, and when all the scientists disappear, then you know you're in trouble. But there's an ethical dilemma of thinking of us as something other than human beings, scientists, right? We wouldn't tell you if an asteroid's going to hit. We wouldn't tell you if the world's going to end. Who's the we here? I'm a human being. I have emotions and reactions, and I'm part of culture and all of that. This separation is something that I've really had to deal with over and over again. And this leads me to my final point. climate change and climate denialism, and how much as a scientist are you allowed to be an advocate when you work for the government? And this argument is going on at NASA right now because we have the largest earth science department in the world, NASA does, specifically. We have the most earth and planetary scientists. Well, let's just stick to earth science. We have the most earth scientists. We run about 30 satellites that study all aspects of the changing systems of the earth. Every single one of them is confirming the existence of climate change, and even that it's going faster than we predicted earlier. And there is no scientific disagreement within NASA, the largest department in the world, about this happening. There's plenty of disagreement about exactly what's happening and which things will be more important and how fast it will go and how accurate our models of the future are. There's plenty of scientific argument about that. But there's a lot of people at NASA, and actually, I'm finding, you know, I agree with this to some extent, stick to the high ground of science. Simply present the facts and hope that the public and the government respond to that. And here's some more facts. And here's some more facts. And what do you think this is actually accomplishing? And what is it doing? We're failing. We're failing to get the message across that this is real and now, and we need to do something about it right away. And how much of an advocate can you become? And there are people like Jim Hansen, who is the director of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, who left the government because he felt that he couldn't be enough of an advocate for what was really happening to the planet. And, you know, Loretta was talking about, you know, what use is NASA? What use is spending these billions of dollars? And when you think about ethical problems, some people don't really understand how deep the need for these blue sky research programs are. Because people talk about NASA spin-offs, and they'll talk about, some people will be humorous and talk about Velcro and Tang, neither of which NASA invented. Other people might actually say, well, look at personal computers. I mean, a lot of the miniaturization of computers started in the Apollo era, when we needed computers to go into space, and that led to the development of a giant new economic technology. So there's all kinds of wonderful spin-offs, but this, I've said this before, but I don't think people understand how literally true this is. The best NASA spin-off I know of is grandchildren. In the 1980s, NASA discovered, working with scientists on the ground and at MIT and other places, the ozone hole. But it was discovered by a NASA satellite simply trying to measure trace gases of the Earth's atmosphere for scientific questions. And we saw this ozone hole opening, we saw the ozone being depleted. NASA scientists and university scientists realized it was due to chlorofluorocarbons, which we were using as coolants in our technologies. And we modeled with our computers how long it would take the ozone layer to basically be completely destroyed. And the year that it would have been done was 2060. 2060 is in our lifetimes. You would have had no livestock or people able to spend any time outside. The crops would have all died. A lot of times I hear scientists talking about how quickly you would have get sunburned, but then they say, well, you wouldn't have cared because there would have been no food production on the planet. You know, do you realize that we almost destroyed the planet? And we got together and we wrote a treaty. It's called the Montreal Protocol. There's still harmful gases we're trying to get added to different treaties. But, you know, the ethics of advocacy and the ethics of saying something needs to change from scientists, from federal scientists, has already saved every single one of your grandchildren. So, I mean that's something you got to think about in terms of the of how, when do scientists cross the line to become an advocate? Thanks.
What's the value of space exploration that can compete against that?
So it's a really good question. I'm never offended when people ask this. Anybody who's involved in this business should think about this and therefore should have some kind of an answer. The one that I first go to, because my specific area of space science is planetary exploration, and I'm involved with some teams that propose and sometimes get to build and fly spacecraft to other planets and learn about the stories of our neighboring planets. And there are a lot of reasons why we do that, of course, and I think one honest answer is we almost can't help it. As human beings, we're curious and we're explorers. We've always done that. I think there's something about the same reason we once left Africa and explored the planet is why we explore the planets. But the greatest benefit, I think, for us is a change in awareness about planets, and that includes a change in awareness about Earth. The time during which we've been launching spacecraft to other planets, really starting in the early 1960s, has also been a time of exploding knowledge and insight about our own planet. Plate tectonics, which is the way Earth works, was unknown at the start of the space age. We were largely unaware of all the important connections between Earth and the other planets. Impacts have been mentioned, and the way that other planetary orbits affect climate change through torquing the spin and the orbit of Earth rhythmically over the ages. And the deep, pervasive presence of life on Earth is something we didn't fully appreciate until we started exploring our lifeless or at least almost lifeless neighbors. And so the insight we've gained about our own planet, and more specifically, there's some environmental crises that have been averted. Michelle mentioned ozone, and there's also a part of the ozone story that has to do with exploring the planet Venus, by the way. Scientists were trying to understand the chemistry of the upper atmosphere of Venus, and they noticed there's something weird about the oxygen up there. There's Venus is mostly CO2, so CO2 is being broken up by ultraviolet light that should be spitting off lots of oxygen. There wasn't much. A lot of these oxygen compounds were missing. And some other scientists said, oh, well, you know, chlorine, if there's chlorine, that can catalytically destroy oxygen compounds. And then that realization helped us understand earlier than we would have otherwise what we were doing to the ozone on Earth. And similarly, acid rain has been mentioned. And Venus is sort of acid rain to the extreme. And it's helped us understand and get a handle on that. And of course, climate. The comparison of climate between Earth and the other planets is one way that we test our climate models and get smarter and really understand how planetary climate works. So there's been a tremendous benefit for our being able to steward this planet and understand what we need to understand now that we find ourselves in the role of being planet changers. Whether we like it or not, we're planet changers. We have to know how planets work. And an important part of that is what we've learned in comparison to the other planets through exploration.
We have to spend here. So I work in the science directorate at NASA. We operate at this moment 108 active missions, okay, 30 Earth science satellites, about 30 satellites that track space weather, what the sun is throwing out to us, all the planetary probes, explorations of Mars and Saturn and Jupiter, the Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, telescopes that study the Big Bang. We employ tens of thousands of people in the science mission directorate. How much a year do you think we spend? What's our budget? $5 billion. Okay. I challenge any organization, public or private, to give you that much output and that much benefit for that small amount of money. The idea that NASA is swimming in money and we could solve the world's problems by adding another $5 billion a year to them, I would love to solve world hunger. Seriously, if it were a choice between space exploration and solving world hunger, I'd pick world hunger. I would. I'm a human being. It ain't going to do it, right? The $5 billion that NASA gets for science every year is about what a good, you know, traffic interchange highway structure costs. So there's a misperception of how much our country is spending on this. So, you know, go have a look over at the defense budget, maybe, or something like that.
You know, if I could make a quick interjection also, world hunger is being solved. Uh-huh. I mean, if you look at the long-term trends, extreme poverty, and NASA is helping with that.
We actually have food security scientists that are actually studying how to help world hunger. He's absolutely right. I was being a little flippant, but given
I like your comparison, and I agree. I would choose world hunger if it was a choice.
That's a great point. Like Planet Labs is putting up these little microsatellites that are getting a Google Earth picture of the Earth every day. So Google Earth, if you look at your house on Google Maps, you know the picture's probably 5 years old. These new satellites, they're going to start coming online this year. We'll be able to get a fresh picture of every piece of land on Earth every day, which we've never had before, not at that resolution. And, that totally supports farmers. And they've already made all that data open source for the state of California and for the country of Kenya so that developers can make apps and help farmers and come up with ways that we can learn how to get all this information out to people in a usable format so that we can solve the problem. So, you know, what's interesting is, like, you know, when you get all these smart people and all these scientists and engineers who want to, you know, are called to, like, make the world a better place, you know, and you start giving them access to ideas and things, you know, it's amazing what can come out of it, you know, and sometimes it's saving the ozone layer, you know, that's pretty profound. Mm-hmm. And so it's that, you know, to quote Donald Rumsfeld again, it's the unknown unknowns. And we got lucky that we just happened to have a satellite up there, and that we were able to catch one of the unknown unknowns in time. And, you know, so the other is sort of a, the other point is like, well, maybe if we're out there doing something in space, that'll help us catch the next one, whether if it's an asteroid that we have to deflect from hitting Los Angeles, or, you know, if it's something, you know, from my field, it's learning about how to live sustainably. What I always wanted to do was create a bioregenerative life support system. So, you know, grow your own food, and the crops you're growing, you know, give you oxygen, and the, you know, they also are recycling your water. So, you know, if I have a settlement on Mars and we're growing food, and then I don't need any more oxygen or any more water. We just keep recycling it over and over, and we're completely contained, sustainable. And like, who on earth doesn't want to learn how to do that? You know, so you can imagine Detroit being like, wow, well, they could do it on Mars. Maybe we should recycle all of our air and water too. And so the technologies we develop and the know-how we develop, and not just the technologies, but even the culture, like, because then it gives the people on Earth the idea, like, oh, we should do this, or we could do this too. And they get inspired to be sustainable on our planet, take care of our home planet by what we're doing. And so I think all this stuff is could end up saving the day.
Well, I've got lots of great questions here. We could move to question time. Does anyone want to say anything to each other before we move into questions? Should we do questions?
You guys are awesome.
Yeah,
I know. We're all awesome. Yes,
we're the dream team of science communicators here.
And I've got awesome questions here. So I am looking at the CWA app. So if you know how to use that, you can shoot me a question. Okay, thank you. I'll read it to you. Can you speculate on the protocols for telling the public, and I think the system is Shell, can you speculate on the protocols for telling the public when NASA and other government organizations confirm artificial radio signals are received?
So Seth Shostak from SETI is here, actually. He's a person that often participates in the panel. So I actually cannot comment specifically on SETI. I would like to ask Seth this question, because I think I'm sure they have a protocol. But the thing that I think is a surprise to all of you is how little we have a protocol, because we are really, really looking forward to making this announcement. Jim Green, the current head of planetary science at NASA, he's getting a little bit old now, but he's hanging on because he wants to be the director of planetary science that announces to the world that we've discovered life. And if anything, NASA seems to err a little bit on the wrong side of that. You know how many times we've discovered water on Mars? We keep saying, yes, again, and again. So, you know, there are several places where we have found tantalizing hints that life might exist, you know, possibly on Mars, possibly on Titan, the moon of Saturn. There was a great announcement yesterday about the oceans of another moon of Saturn. As soon as we understand that this is really scientifically solid, you know, the peers get together, we all look and see that we really understand that this is true, we are going to publish this as soon as we possibly can. We are so looking forward to this. So there's sort of an idea that maybe NASA, once we have the information that there's life, in this case I'm talking more microbial life than radio signals because I don't really know about Seth's stuff, that's more Seth. There's this idea that maybe we get together with Russia and China, and maybe we get together with the Vatican, or we can consult religious authorities, and we figure about how to very safely get this information out and not cause a panic. No. No. This is a scientific result. We are really, really anxious for it. We will announce it as soon as we are sure that we're looking at life. We are chafing at the bit. So this idea that there's a protocol about who we need to consult and who we need to get approval from and what the schedule will be is not the reality.
There actually is a very specific protocol, not for microbes, but for if you have a radio observatory and you think you've possibly detected a signal. And you don't tell the public at first. And it has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with we get a lot of false alarms and where it's almost surely not a real signal. So the protocol is you first do a couple of things just on your own to rule out obvious things. You look what's called off-axis. So you just change the direction of your telescope a little bit. And if the signal's still there, and you're no longer pointing at that distant star, then almost surely it's a mistake because it's something more local. And this happens a lot. There's sources of radio interference. The first time ever we detected Frank Drake in his first ever search for radio signals, Project Ozma, found something right off the bat. And he said, this is too good to be true. But it turned out it was intelligence, but it was military intelligence. That oxymoron, not extraterrestrial intelligence. It was some military facility. So you go off access, you check it. And then the next thing you do, you don't alert the public. You call other radio observatories and you say, can you see this too? And, you know, believe me, every radio observatory in the world is going to say, they're going to want to look. And then if they see it too, then the next thing you do is you tell everybody.
Yeah. But there's a misperception that we would ever try to suppress this information as soon as we have it. My God, we're so looking forward to it.
Okay, let's have another question. So this is another question from a student, an interesting question, I think. How is our ethical responsibility to spread life where it isn't any different from colonization and white people saying it was their ethical burden to civilize other cultures?
Yeah, that was what I wanted to say about learning from the past. If you had been alive then, you'd have been like, oh, these natives, you know, they don't count. You know, we're just going to go do what we want. And in these days, you know, there are some people, obviously not these two, but some people say, oh, these are microbes, they don't count. And no matter how you feel about microbes, just from history, you might want to go like, I think I've heard that somewhere before. Maybe we should think twice before we say that again. So yeah, I definitely want us to be a little more mindful, because they're just microbes, but maybe in 200 years, you know, they'll look at us a little bit differently with how we treated microbes.
I went to a meeting of the Mars Society here in Boulder about 15 years ago. The Mars Society, they're people that really want to send people to Mars, and they do some really cool stuff and have some really cool ideas, but one of the leaders of the society got up and said, it is our manifest destiny to bring people to Mars. And I had two competing impulses to vomit and to throttle the guy, because that's exactly the wrong thing to say, because manifest destiny is associated with this Christian Western imperialist assumption that these are our places to take, even though there are other people living there and another civilization to destroy. What is different is that there is no Martian civilization. There may be a Martian biosphere, and that is why, as I said earlier, I think we should tread very lightly at first until we understand more about what's going on. But there's, to me, it's ethically fundamentally different, because there is nobody to displace. And that's really important. But again, it's the language we use is really important, because we have made mistakes, and it makes sense to draw these historical analogies. And then I think it makes sense to draw the distinctions.
Okay, here's a question from a sophomore at Palisade High School. How would political influence change how one settles another planet? Would the world, and I think the idea is with the world with its, you know, complicated political conflicts between nations, would that support planetary settlement, or would it cause tension?
Yeah, it's a great question, because, even right now, you know, one of the, in the old school thinking in Congress, you know, they still get motivated by competition. And so someone will go to Congress and say, oh, China is planning to build a base on the moon. And then the white hairs and the old school thinkers in Congress will be like, what? We can't let China beat us to the moon? And they're like, I've got to go to the moon. Let's go. And so, you know,
we're kind of hoping for this at NASA, actually.
Yeah, sometimes people game that a little bit. My goal is, so for me, space is a blank slate. And to me, one of the most precious resources in space is that opportunity to start from scratch. You know, there's like an Arab settlement on Mars. There's always people joking, you know, if you really want to get to Mars quickly, just get the Mormons to do it, because they're very efficient and they can totally handle that. So it's interesting. You might get these sort of different groups. And so we need to be thinking about how do we, from my perspective, like, how do we work together? How do we get them to work to support each other? How do we use the same standards so that if your drill dies, that they have the same battery packs at their base, so you can get to go borrow a battery pack from their base? You know, that we've, you know, you don't have to bring a electrical chain, you know, charger thing, plug, like converter, like you have to bring to Europe. Like, come on, let's get this right this time, guys.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fact of history, and there's some irony that the big push for space exploration, which led to this amazing and now obviously vital increase in planetary awareness and consciousness about our our the nature of what we are and where we are on this planet came out of this deadly Cold War competition where these two superpowers were trying to prove to each other that they could, you know, blast each other back to the Stone Age, and our rockets are better than your rockets. I mean, that is why we went to the moon, and the scientists got to kind of ride on the coattails of that. But we've shown since then that we can explore for other reasons, and you know, I think a lot of us in the space business are motivated by some version of the United Federation of Planets, where you've got, you know, the Asian navigator and the you know, or the Russian, the Scottish engineer, and that, you know, we're sort of all doing this for humanity going out into space. But you know, we have to deal with the situation that we have and the things that motivate us. And you know, I think now the ethical conundrum, it's less about the fact that international competition is motivating us, but it's the whole profit thing, and some people are uncomfortable with that. It's like, are we just going to become space capitalists? And yet that is what makes a lot of stuff happen on Earth, and that is what's making a lot of stuff happen in space. And as we've seen on Earth, you know, a lot of good stuff comes out of the innovation from that, but we don't want Elysium. So there's some interesting question of how we guide that.
It does seem to me, you know, I when you ask the question why explore space and why, you know, spend the resources on it, have we really lost the concept of something being noble? You know, something being inspiring, you know, something being worth doing because of pure curiosity and the purity of the human spirit? Really? Can we talk about this? Can we talk about the fact that when I return these, you know, when I show people these gorgeous images from Saturn that are coming in, I feel part of something noble. We can embrace that. That's okay. I can give you all the economic arguments. Every dollar invested in NASA gives $2 return at least to our technology, to our food security, all of that. It's so bland. It's noble to explore. It's noble to try to learn something new. We can embrace that too.
Okay. Here's a question that's more of a factual question, but I think some of the ethical questions we're talking about hang on this. The question is, what's the extent of the ecosystem required to support humans for a long time external to the Earth? And I think the larger question the questioner has in mind is, you know, how realistic is it that there's going to be the kind of colonization, or whatever we've decided to call it, that sort of raises some of these hard ethical questions? What sort of technology is required? How close are we to it?
Well, in my view, I bet it's going to be much harder to build a settlement on Mars than we think. And we're going to learn something by the fact that the first attempts fail or have more trouble. Just as Biosphere 2, you know, we found people thought, well, we'll build this other enclosed biosphere. And it was harder because than we thought, because we're still learning a lot about the relationship between organisms and their environment. And here on Biosphere 1, Earth, we are learning all the time how little we know. We've just recently discovered so much about the microbiome of human beings and other organisms, that most of you is not you, or really it is you, but what a human being is not what we thought, that there are all these other organisms living within you that are not just germs, invaders, diseases, but in fact essential parts of your biology are the organisms living within you. And that relationship with the biology within us and the relationship with the other organisms and the way we're exchanging gases and matter and energy with our environments is more complex than we used to think. And we're learning about that. And the marvelous thing about imagining trying to build a space habitat is we have to deal with that. We have to be able to understand our relationship with our environment enough to bring what we need. It was one thing for the astronauts to go to the moon for a couple of days and then come scurrying back. But to really do it in a sustainable way, Kim Stanley Robinson, who's been mentioned before in this discussion, has this great, his second to most recent novel is called 2312, and it's 300 years in the future, and people are living all over the solar system, but they've discovered that if you don't come back to Earth every few years, you get sick. And so everybody has to. And Earth is, in his future, Earth is having problems, but it's okay. We're still here, but there's, you know, sea level rises happen and all this. It's a good book. But I'm interested in this notion that it may not be exactly the way Stan envisions it, but that we're more dependent on Earth and more deeply tied to it in ways that we haven't figured out yet, I think is likely. So, I mean, I'm all in favor of us trying to do this because it's noble and all these other things, but also because we'll learn a lot. We'll learn by how hard it is, which I predict it's going to be hard. We'll learn important things about ourselves and our relationship to our planet.
I guess one of the things, you know, I mean, not only do you need to have a huge amount of like food growing and oxygen generating capability and all of this, but I have a lot of friends who are astronauts who deal with the effects on their body of having spent significant amounts of time in space. And yes, we are getting better at this. We're very much getting better at this. But it is still really, really hard on the human body to spend an extended amount of time in space. You know, one example is there are vision problems right now that we're trying to get better at helping. But the human brain was actually built to kind of sit in a brain case under gravity. You know, even if you're lying down, there's gravity in different directions. And without gravity, your brain kind of floats. And something about your skull tends to direct the brain forward, and it actually puts pressure on your eyes. And the question is, how much gravity stops this? So the gravity of the moon is about 1/6 the gravity of the Earth. Is that enough so that this effect doesn't happen? What about Mars? You know, Mars is about a third the gravity. You know, I mean, we still don't really understand how to make the human body work well in these different gravity environments. You know, a lot of my astronaut friends are dealing with really screwed up shoulders from the way that they had to stand differently and work differently in space because they didn't have gravity to kind of anchor them down. You know, they still pee their bones out. You know, I mean, the bones feel basically unappreciated in zero gravity, and they tend to disappear. And there's so much calcium going through their urine that it clogs up our toilets all the time on the space station. So, you know, there are ways that we are trying and succeeding. People are healthier now. They're stronger now. A lot of the ways that we're actually helping people survive in space longer. But the fundamental question of how well does the human body work without genetic adaptation and bioengineering and maybe things in the future we'll be able to do. But right now, the human body isn't doing all that great for long extended space travel. So we have a lot of work to do there.
Hey, I got one question about the vision problems.
Yeah.
And I think it's safe to ask this in Boulder, Colorado. Why doesn't NASA try cannabis?
Ah, yes. Yeah.
It reduces, one of its effects is that it reduces intraocular pressure. And I bet you could find some volunteers for that experiment.
I sure hope they have. If it actually really is just, you know, a good solution would be giving the astronauts cannabis, I would hope that we would be open-minded enough to use that.
Yeah. Oh, man, we forgot to close the airlock.
Yeah.
So you may have just answered your own question.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, I've got two very similar questions here. I'm going to kind of merge them into one, and I think maybe this is for Loretta first and foremost. The private sector is getting involved in space activities, and the primary motivation is money, not altruism and knowledge. So how can the commercial and economic drivers behind exploration be limited?
The primary driver, so first of all, I'm going to push back on the primary driver is money. So if you think about the biggest players right now, it's Elon Musk at SpaceX, Jeff Bezos at Blue Origin, and Richard Branson at Virgin Galactic. And, you know, if you look at what all three of them are saying, like, it has absolutely nothing to do with money. Like, now, they're business advisors are like, boss, this is a stupid idea, stop doing this, all the time. And they have to deal with their fiscal realities, and, you know, Elon already went broke once and had to make it all again, you know, so they have, that's the world they live in. They live in a business world. They have to deal with business realities. But all three of them, I mean, if you think of Elon's story, and all three of them, they, you know, when they made all this money, they made all the money somewhere else. And then they, you know, Elon had this, you know, he's out in the cabin in the wilderness with his college buddy. And he's like, Jesus, I'm a millionaire now. What do I do? Well, now what do I do? You know, now imagine that. Imagine you just had this windfall and you're like 29 years old or something. And you're like, now what do I do with the rest of my life? And what the question he asks himself is like, okay, what could I do from here that will have the biggest impact on humanity? That was the question he asked. And he's like, and he decided for him, you know, for him, it was Mars. And Bezos, you know, for him, you know, he didn't expect to be that successful with Amazon. But he said, okay, now I can fulfill my childhood dream. I mean, when Bezos was at Princeton, he was at SEDS. He was, you know, a little space geek at school. You know, he's like, I want to go to space. So now he's fulfilling on his childhood dream of getting millions of people living and working in space, and the idea that if you bring the cost of space access down so that, you know, any hackers or any, you know, entrepreneurs can do stuff, that, like, amazing stuff will happen. So these guys are definitely, I would say they're totally thinking about, you know, about the big picture. So I don't think you have to get them off thinking about making money. Now, there are people who are thinking about making money too, and I worry about them. That's my job. You know, I'm sort of I'm the space ethicist. You know, and my job is to be in the community and inspire my colleagues to make sure that what they're doing is mindful and respectful and sustainable and taking care and, you know, doing what's best for us as a species.
Well, ones that we've already covered are the ones that are raised. Obviously, there is the question of resources that could potentially be spent for other things, but we've kind of covered that ground. With New Horizons, it's hard to imagine any other ethical objection. New Horizons is the spacecraft that just went by Pluto in July 2015, which, by the way, began with a bunch of students at CU Boulder in 1989 saying, hey, could we send a mission to Pluto? And these students at CU Boulder were told, no, that's crazy. It'll never happen, kids. And that same gang of kids, same people at the core, are now middle-aged scientists who just succeeded in sending a mission past Pluto. Returning fabulous images and expanding
yes.
our
yes.
minds about the possibilities of planets in the universe. What could possibly be the objection? Okay, one thing is that a mission did launch with plutonium. And Michelle's already mentioned that NASA does some pretty amazing things with these RTGs, radioisotopic thermoelectric generators, packs the plutonium in these pellets that it's very hard to do something unsafe with. But that is a possible objection. Other than that, it's hard for me to see. With the radio telescopes, there is the possibility, what if we discover something that is dangerous? Or what if we get a message from aliens and there are these science fiction scenarios. It tells us to build a machine, and we build the machine, and it does something awful. One can imagine possible dangers, but they don't seem that credible to me. And so those projects you mentioned seem to me almost, you know, amongst the things we're talking about, the most free of ethical complications.
I suppose there's sort of a basic cultural ethical, if you want to take ethics in a very, very broad context. I mean, I do remember, you know, the most beautiful telescope on the Earth right now is still Mount Palomar. It's a 200-inch telescope. It's very old. It was built, finished in the 1940s or something like that. But, you know, I do remember that there's a bullet that's lodged into the glass of the mirror at Mount Palomar, because as the mirror was being delivered, somebody actually tried to destroy the mirror because they thought the telescope would disprove the existence of God.
Wow.
There you go.
Honestly, this is something as scientists we don't really talk about, right? I mean, we don't get together and say, maybe the James Webb Space Telescope will give us a better handle on what set the Big Bang off. You know, I mean, you know, we already understand really what the meaning of life is, in the sense that we are all atoms forged in stars that then gravity brought together in planets, and you just leave carbon alone and it starts to bond with itself, and there you got life. So, I mean, there's some people might say that scientists are a little callous about the ethics of the larger cultural context of religion and spirituality. You know, we keep pushing back where people say, you know, well, did God cause this? Even to people, I'm very good friends with Guy Consolmagno, who's the director of the Vatican Observatory. And none of us, you know, Brother Guy certainly doesn't think that God is hiding at the limit of human knowledge, right? You know, whatever we don't understand, that must be God. You know, at first it was Thor with lightning bolts, then, okay, we got lightning. It wasn't Thor. You know, I mean, God isn't where we push him or it back to.
Or her.
Or her. I don't like using any sort of gender for God. But so I think perhaps people might be surprised to know that scientists don't really worry about that. Maybe some people think we should. It's an interesting discussion. But we will someday get a handle, I think, on what set off the Big Bang. Then there will be more questions. What happened with that? You know, I don't think there's an end, at least in the course of human existence, an end to the questions that we'll be answering and asking. But that's a different way of looking at the ethics of some of these very large deep space missions.
Okay, it's clear now that I've got way more good questions than we've got time for. We've only got a couple of minutes left, so this might be the last question. It's a tough one, but we're supposed to be asking the tough questions. I think it's perhaps best to push this towards Loretta, at least initially. Are there emissions associated with continuous jets going into space, especially when more commercial flights are going up? If so, how do you counter the argument we're prioritizing space over Earth?
This is an incredibly, incredibly good question, very good question, and it's something I wrestle with personally a lot. So the answer is yes, rockets make emissions, and the worst part is that they make emissions in the high atmosphere, and we don't even know everything about that, you know, because it takes money to do some of it, you know. So that is something I personally bear and worry about. The way I think about it right now is that rocket launches are very rare or very infrequent. You know, SpaceX is hoping to launch a rocket a month this year, and that's a profoundly high rate of launch. Like, everyone's like, whoa, you guys are doing amazing, 12 launches in a year, that's breakthrough. There are very few rocket launches in the world a year, and you know, we're the same way, Virgin Galactic's the same way, we'll have very few launches. If you think about it in the context of aviation in general, which has 50,000 airplanes in the air at any given moment, and you know, and they're, you know, that's a 747 flying across the ocean or something. So, in the grand scheme of things, you know, I justify it to myself by saying, you know, it's a drop in the bucket. Now, what I have to deal with is that our goal as an industry is that we have 50,000 rockets flying a day, right? Like, we'll know we've made it when people are falling asleep on launch. Like, yeah, wake me up when I'm in Tokyo. This is great. So one of the things that I'm working for, toward, like I said, like I'm trying to be the space ethicist for our industry, is helping, like, move us towards technology so that when we have those kinds of frequencies, we're using the technologies that are the most green. So, like, for example, Blue Origin is using fuels, they're using hydrogen and oxygen the way the space shuttle did, and you put hydrogen and oxygen together and it makes water. Oh, don't put water in the atmosphere. So that's I love that system because it's so elegant. And so I'm always kind of like bugging the engineers. I'm like, can we use water, please? Please, please. And they're always like, no, Loretta, you have to use, you got to keep it cooled, and that's a big pain in the ass. And I'm like, yeah, but it's water. It's really cool. So, you know, we got to start pushing, you know, to find better solutions so that we can use these kinds. So these technologies exist, you know, to make sure that we can make it affordable or practical to be able to us to utilize them. And when we are scaling up our operations, that's going to help us a lot. And then the other things, even for airplanes and rockets, there's also, I have this other, I'm good with pipe dreams, and the engineers are always like telling me why they're not feasible, but they will be feasible at some point, like any good technology. And the other thing I want to do is I want to have space-based solar power, which isn't practical now economically, but someday it will be. And I would love to have where you beam this, so you're getting solar power from the sun 24 hours a day because you're out in space, and you beam that power to your rocket or to your airplanes, ideally all 50,000 airplanes. And so they're not even getting power from the ground. They're just getting it straight from the sun. And so, you know, I like to think, you know, I was born 100 years too early. So I like to think the long-term solutions, you know, and then I leave it to the engineers. Okay, now build it for me. Yeah, figure it out. But so I think we can do it, and we can do it green, and we just have to, you know, create the demand and get the smart people working on it in research labs and schools and studying hard, and so we can build this dream, this future of our dreams.
Okay.
There's one other. Can I just say quickly, there's one other dimension.